We're going to talk about the 10 perfections tonight, the 10 paramis. I spoke of one, renunciation, a little while ago. I'm going to cover another one this evening. But firstly, to introduce the subject, I'd like to cover a few general points about these paramis. They figure very largely in the Mahayana way, and they are the perfections which a bodhisattva undertakes in his training. It's said then that these are qualities of mind and behavior which are necessary if you want to become someone who is of value to the world. They cannot of themselves lead to enlightenment, but they can make life an awful lot easier than often it is. They calm the mind, they smooth out the behavior, they ensure that one's relationships with other people are the most harmless that one can possibly imagine. In short, they work very much towards harmony in the world. They work very much towards harmony in the mind. They tend, in fact, to break down the barriers between beings, and that's something which is terribly important in any social setting, in any age, in any culture. It's so very easy to manufacture barriers, prejudices of race, of colour, of sex, all kinds of prejudice. Class structures of any kind are evidence of prejudice. Practicing the paramis, the perfections, will tend to break down those barriers and make easier communication between people at any level, at any culture. They indeed conduce to ease of living here and now. I'd like, if I can, to run through the 10 to show you how they are thought of. The person, the being on his or her way to enlightenment, undertakes these 10 perfections with a view to the weal and welfare of all beings, self included. So he gives generously, so that people's lives may be benefited, so that their paths may be smoothed. He practices sila, or discipline, precepts if you like, in order to become as harmless as possible to other beings and to himself. And he then practices renunciation, nekamma, to perfect that discipline, that morality as it's often called. He will try to purify his wisdom, his panya, so that he may truly know what is beneficial to beings and what is not beneficial. For indeed, it's not a lot of good going around doing good works unless you know truly that they are good. And with that in mind, with purified wisdom, he works, he exerts energy, wirya, effort or energy, in a tireless attempt to ensure that all beings are looked after as best as he can manage within the circumstances. Having become a hero with respect to the expenditure of energy, he then exercises kanti, or forbearance, toward the manifold failures of beings, the manifold faults of beings. He tries always to do what he's promised to do, and that is what is meant by satya, or truthfulness. It's trying to be true to your promises, trying always to carry out anything that you said you will do. He works with unshakable resolution, determination for the welfare of beings, and also with unshakable friendliness for all beings, whether they be human or non-human, it doesn't matter. And lastly, but by no means least, he exercises his equanimity, his upekha, recognizing that he cannot expect any thanks for all his tremendous efforts. I think that one's got a nice little twist in the tail, don't you? Because so often is it the case that people who do work hard for others' benefit get no thanks for it at all. Those are the 10 parami, the 10 perfections. And as I said before, they're not extremes. Whilst indeed one has to work them up to quite a considerable level, it is quite possible to go overboard and get an overplus of any one of these qualities. Bear in mind that the parami are for one's own welfare and for the welfare of other beings, and that implies always a balance. Tonight I want to look at kanti, forbearance or patience, in a little more detail. So what is it? It's forbearance, or tolerance if you like, towards the manifest and manifold failings of other people. Isn't it easy to see the faults of others? Far more difficult it is to see one's own faults. Constantly we are beset by things other people do wrongly, it seems, or say wrongly. If you sit quietly in a crowded place and listen to the conversations going on around you, it's really quite instructive, quite illuminating, because 5 out of 6 conversations perhaps are about people and what they've done wrong. There isn't an awful lot of forbearance around. Indeed, quite often quite a lot of anger and resentment is generated by those who concentrate so much on the faults of other people. It's often said that it's a good thing to have a moan once in a while, it clears the air. Well, it might do, but at the same time it has certain disadvantages, not least of which is you end up feeling distinctly put upon, and that being so, it's quite clear, if you examine the thing dispassionately, that resentment is very easy to arouse by concentrating on the faults of other people. So why should forbearance, tolerance, patience, why should it be considered as a perfection, a parami, one of those 10 which are so crucial if one is going to become of benefit and value to the world, to become someone who is considered worthy? What it does, if you think about it, is protect the mind from the arising of anger, from the arising of hatred. It protects the mind from the arising of resentment. Indeed, kanti, forbearance, protects the mind from the arising of all destructive urges. For one is not only forbearing towards others' faults, although that's its primary intention, but one should also be forbearing towards one's own. So how then is it applied? How does one apply kanti, forbearance, in one's daily life? I suspect many of us do it quite a lot anyway without even really thinking about it, but it does help to actively become conscious of the states of mind and what is running. It's what's commonly called turning the other cheek. It's forbearing to take offence when people act in a way which you find distasteful. Let's see if we can get some concrete examples to illustrate the point. It's not uncommon for people to experience at some point during their lives bad treatment of some kind or another. I personally have been spat at on more than one occasion, but that's what you get when you go travelling. It would never happen in England, or would it? But being spat at is not a very pleasant experience, and I can quite imagine that it would be very, very easy to get extremely angry. And indulge what people are pleased to call righteous anger or righteous indignation at such a thing. But that would not be to exercise forbearance. To exercise forbearance would be to refuse to let anger or resentment or irritation arise on such an act. Some people have been mugged or otherwise beaten. I know one old lady, she used to come along to us when we had the meditation center in Hampstead. She was, when I say old lady, she must have been about, I think she was over 70, and she was a bit shaky. And she got mugged one night and her handbag stolen. Not a pleasant experience at the best of times, obviously. But she suffered worse than perhaps many others might have done, for she became totally full of hatred for people who would do such a thing, and it preyed upon her mind to a very serious extent. It's a very serious thing to occur to anybody, it doesn't matter how old they are, but at the same time there are ways and ways of coping with it. If she had been able to practice forbearance, if she had been able to not allow hatred to consume her mind, she would have had then all the positive resources at her disposal for coping with the inevitable dislocation such an event implies. But she didn't do that. She indulged her hatred and her resentment, and it made life exceedingly difficult for her for months afterwards. Forbearance has an extremely positive aspect to it then, even though many people might feel that it was quite sensible to be angry at such a happening. People have things stolen. I know one couple who moved into a new house. They got it all kitted out very nicely. And they'd been there perhaps a couple of years or so, and they had a burglary. The burglar took some things of value, but overall it wasn't a tremendous loss to them, but it was an enormous disruption because they became quite desolate about the fact that their home had been violated. And they felt they did not feel safe anymore. They allowed all kinds of hatred and resentment to arise about the event, about the burglar, about the burglary itself. This magnified the whole event to such a proportion that they felt the place to be no longer their own and had to move. Had they exercised forbearance, whilst again it's not a pleasant situation to be in, that would not have escalated to the degree that it did. What about another situation? A good friend of mine was driving along in his car one day in a residential area, and out from behind a parked car ran a little girl, 5 years old. He knocked her down and killed her. One of those things, he could do nothing about it. She just appeared in front of the car. He was so distraught. But what about the parents? Do you know they didn't blame him? They, if you like, exercised forbearance, patience, tolerance, understanding of that kind. And I thought at the time that that was quite remarkable. This fellow actually said it made it worse in one way, because he was left with that inevitable question, could I have avoided it? And he had no one that he could turn his his own anger and distress towards. He was left holding the baby, so to speak. He would have been wise to practice forbearance toward his own states of mind. One can go on magnifying, multiplying examples of this kind. There are so many. What about a slightly different twist, though, on forbearance? What about the situation everybody knows where they work very hard for somebody else, a typical person who works very, very hard and is often unappreciated is a housewife and mother, slaving away all day, not a single thought of thanks, not a single indication of gratitude. It would be very easy, it is very easy under those circumstances, to become angry that one's sterling qualities are not recognized, that one's sacrifice is not recognized. One begins to think how ungrateful people are, how thoughtless, how inconsiderate. There's a wonderful occasion for exercising forbearance with the manifold faults of others. The wage earner, usually the husband, the man of the house, may well feel similar in that he goes out and joins in the rat race day after day, and what thanks does he get? And he too, if he's not careful, can allow resentments, anger, irritation, ill will to arise because he is not appreciated for the work and the sacrifice he puts in. He too can practice forbearance. When members of a family do practice forbearance, that family is very much closer knit, is stronger, is happier, is more tranquil, is more joyful than if they do not practice forbearance. What about the situation which sometimes occurs where a child getting on through the teens and the 20s finds himself or herself having to look after a sick parent, a bedridden parent? What happens if that parent lingers on and on and on, and that child goes through the 20s and the 30s and the 40s still feeling that they have to look after that parent? It does happen. I know someone like that who became very bitter at one point, but realized, without having to be told, that bitterness, that anger, that resentment wasn't worth it. That it was just beginning to eat away like a cancer at the person who allowed it to arise. She managed to exercise forbearance and found her life changed for the better, even though she knew that her mother was in fact pretending to be, on occasions, far worse than actually she was. She managed to cope with it just the same. A tremendous sacrifice, a tremendous growth in my view, because circumstances like that are very often due to past action. It is resultants of past deeds that one is having to work out in this particular life. I think it's fair to say that nearly every really close relationship you have has its roots in past time somewhere. Not everyone, but most of them. As Gotama himself said, how many times has each one of us been mother, brother, aunt, uncle, father, son, daughter to the people we know? Can you get an image of this endless round of birth and death, choosing to come back as a different sex, in a different relationship to the people you know and love, or perhaps know and hate, so that you can work things out so that you can learn lessons, so that you can gradually, painfully, slowly sometimes, but gradually work your way toward a disenchantment with samsara, with the round of birth and death, and an urge for release, for nibbana, for the cessation of dukkha, the cessation of unsatisfactoriness. This life is one giant school, if you will, where some of the lessons we have to learn have got nothing to do with school books, have got nothing to do with commerce and industry, have got nothing to do with earning a living in that sense, but have everything to do with human relationships. And where do most of us have most trouble? Human relationships. What's the biggest hothouse for trouble in human relationships? The family unit, always. So, coming back to forbearance, everybody has a perfect opportunity to exercise forbearance wherever they happen to be, because no one can live isolated from his fellows, even though they might try. Other areas where forbearance becomes really quite important, I think, is in the area of speech. It is quite easy to listen to a rumour, think, my goodness, is that really true? And then pass it round. Have you heard that so-and-so is doing so-and-so to so-and-so? And before you know where you are, everyone is certain that there's something really awful going on when the rumour wasn't even true in the first place. One can forbear, then, to indulge in gossip. One can forbear to indulge in slander of any kind. One can forbear to practice any kind of wrong speech. It's often hard going, but again, it conduces to harmony between beings, and it conduces to harmony in one's own mind. Talking of one's own mind, how does one practice forbearance to that? We all know that there's a lot wrong, a lot that we perceive as undesirable about the mind. Some of us really get quite upset about it, and maybe even indulge in self-hatred because of it. Could we not exercise a little forbearance towards the faults we perceive in ourselves? Could we not treat ourselves at least as well as we treat other people? Or perhaps we do that anyway, in which case we need to sharpen up in two areas. Forbearance is a very powerful tool. There is in Majjhima Nikaya a discourse called the Parable of the Saw, which I'm sure I know some of you are familiar with. And essentially, Gautama is talking about metta, friendliness, but it can also well be applied to forbearance. He says, if you should be set upon by bandits — he's talking to his monks, but it applies to all meditators, indeed all people really — if you should be set upon by bandits and sawn limb from limb with a two-handed saw — pretty gruesome, isn't it? — if any one of you should allow hatred to arise in the mind even for an instant, you are no meditators of mine, he said. What a goal to aim for. So how much easier must it be, then, if one tries patiently to endure things like abuse, mistreatment of various kinds, non-appreciation, let alone abuse, it is certainly possible to be forbearing in those circumstances, and it is of inestimable profit in the longer term. It's also a profit in the short term, of course. The soft answer does really turn away wrath. You don't have to get angry in response to anger. If you are forbearing, you try and keep your cool, and that usually, or in most cases, will defuse the situation. So, why practice the paramis at all? In particular, why practice forbearance? You practice forbearance for peace of mind, for harmony between beings. Where do beings exist? Obviously they exist in the world, but in one very real sense, you can say that beings exist in one's own mind. Who has not been through a harrowing time with some friends or enemies, and woken up at 2 a.m. with a mind going round and round and round, with this person and that person and the other person so clearly pictured and heard that they might just as well be present? Where do those beings exist at that time? They exist in one's own mind, don't they? And in a very real sense, you can say that all beings exist in your own mind. So if you practice forbearance, where do you first practice it? You practice it towards beings in your own mind. You restrain your thinking when it starts to go negative about other people. You restrain your tendency to find fault with other people. You try and be forbearing about the faults that they certainly have. But you try not to let hatred or anger or irritation or ill will arise. If then the mind can become calm in this way, you yourself become a centre of peace and quiet, of harmony, of tolerance. You become, as it were, a source of harmony, and those people whom you contact will feel more comfortable in your presence than if you did not practice forbearance in this way. In short, your external relationships will become very much smoother and more profitable to all concerned. You will begin to spread harmony around you in your environment, and thus conduce to the overall peacefulness of that environment. You'll find, too, that as your mind becomes calmer and more peaceful, you are more easily able to undertake the practice of pavana, mental development, specifically meditation. You'll find that the mind becomes concentrated more easily, that it is less fractured and less upset, less of a turmoil. And that being so, you can see more clearly what is going on in there. You can see things rising and passing away more easily, because the mind is not distraught over some imagined fault or slight from somebody else. In short, the whole life becomes easier and calmer. If you practice pavana properly, it will lead you all the way to the gateway to enlightenment. And pavana, mental development, is in fact dependent upon a certain balance of mental and physical right behavior, of which forbearance is a part. It's not all of it, of course, but it is a very important part. At the gateway to enlightenment, or as the Tibetans put it, sitting in a Bodhi mandala. What one does then simply is to observe and to wait. And in its own good time, enlightenment strikes. It visits you. There's nothing you can do, other than what you have done, to bring it about. For it is not something produced, nor something created. And when that happens, it's the most marvelous event that there could ever be. For all of a sudden, everything is utterly different. Nothing stays the same. Everything, as it were, dissolves. And then you begin to realize that in a very special way, although everything is utterly different, it is at the same time exactly the same as always it has been. And yet, and this is the critical point, there is no longer any attachment. There is no attachment whatsoever to anything. The mind is suddenly totally free. It's free from every conceivable hindrance. It's free from all ignorance. It's free from all craving. It's free from all hatred. It's free from all of the negative states. It has even gone beyond the positive states. There is no attachment of any sort whatsoever. No longer is one's destiny believed to lie in some mystical heaven world. No longer is happiness seen as getting that larger house or that rise in salary. No longer is happiness seen as finding the perfect relationship. All of these things are known to be transitory, ephemeral. Things are seen to be utterly perfect as they are, and constantly changing, so that there is no point at which you can make an attachment, because things change so rapidly. And in all of that, there's a total deep peace and stillness which really cannot be described. That peace and stillness allows of a tremendous dynamism. Life actually takes on a sparkle, a vibrancy, a clarity, and if you like, a certain excitement that it could never have had before, whilst obscured by ignorance and craving and hatred. And it's then that you really can see the benefit of the paramis. For enlightenment is losing of all attachment. It is not suddenly producing positive traits of character. It is not suddenly being able to achieve, say, jhana concentration levels. It is simply losing all attachment. So in one way, you don't change at all. And yet in another way, it's a total mental revolution. So you're left very much as you were before, with the same physical characteristics and to a degree with the same mental characteristics. Except for one thing, there is no attachment. Now, it then becomes obvious that if you have trained the mind in what one might call positive characteristics, things like forbearance, then those are with you still. And they make for a very much more comfortable life, a very much more peaceful life. They make for what the books call living in ease here and now. So those 10 parami are of inestimable value both before and after enlightenment, whilst this body still exists, because they aid one's lifestyle. They aid in living, they provide ease of living whenever they are practiced. And ease of living is something which is delightful to have. So the parami, then, are always worthwhile. The parami promote health, they promote harmony, they promote tranquility amongst people. And that's a very valuable thing to have.